The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Jemima Kish, and welcome to Tech Weekly, brought to you by The Guardian. This week, Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor, speaks to Oliver Pilgersdorfer from BlackBerry about this week's big launch of their new handset, the BlackBerry Z10. Also, Charles meets a British tech pioneer, Keith Teer.
Trying to raise money with a Yorkshire accent from British-based venture capitalist Reasonet was not just hard, but impossible.
Now a big player in the US about his latest venture, the Just.me app, which Keith claims is setting out to make the mobile truly social. We'll also have a roundup of this week's top tech stories, including rumours that the Chinese games console ban might be lifted and why Ashton Kutcher ended up in hospital while preparing to play the late Steve Jobs. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. This week, RIM, now called BlackBerry, launched a clear bid to take on the might of Apple and Samsung. Ahead of the launch, Charles Arthur met BlackBerry's Director of Communications, Oliver Pilgersdorfer, to discuss handsets and the future of this embattled company.
Welcome, Oliver. The launch of BlackBerry 10 occurred this week. Just run us through what the key features are of this new operating system and these new handsets, indeed, that you think make them compelling for people who are either in a company or just individuals looking to buy a new phone.
Sure. Hi, Charles, firstly. Thank you for having us here. And yes, today and this week we've been revealing to the world the new BlackBerry 10 operating system, which is really built for hyper-connected multitaskers. It's a brand new platform for BlackBerry, and you know, we spent a long time developing this platform to ensure that it really meets the needs of these hyper-connected multitaskers. And so, I've built in some very, very core features into the first products that will be launched using the operating system, including some of which include the BlackBerry Flow functionality, the BlackBerry Hub, which is a great place to access all of your messages and your connections and all of your social feeds as well. And then also included new features and upgrades to things like BBM, including BBM voice and also BBM video chat, as well as having some very, very lovely features that you can use with the camera functionality. So something called Time Shift that we've included, which enables you to mutate the different pictures that you take, so you ensure that you'll always have that perfect picture with people either smiling or not as you feel fit.
And why would someone go for this over, say, an Android phone or an iPhone?
Yeah, well, the thing that we recognise for those people that are, these multitaskers who are always hyper-connected is they want a device that delivers them a great experience. So our engineers over the past 2 years, they've really taken the essence of what BlackBerry stands for and tried to really dig under that and deliver something that is really focused on a great experience. And so you'll notice on the first device that we're going to make available in the UK, which is the Z10, we've ensured that it's a very simple device to use. And things like there's no back button and the display is very, very crisp and easy to use. It means that you can always flow through your daily life and your connection. So it's very simple for you to stay in touch with everything that's important to you.
You've got things like swipe gestures, and in terms of the functionality and the way that it works, there's a sort of gestural interface which reminds me rather of the Palm Pre and also, of course, of the BlackBerry Playbook, because BlackBerry Playbook had, if I'm right, a forerunner of the BlackBerry 10 software. It's not exactly the same, but it's pretty similar. What is the thinking in no back button? Because obviously the back button is a big thing in Android. And when you say flow, I mean, is that how people think about things? Do they, is gestures and flowing, has that been the missing element? Because you describe the hub, for example, and it sounds a bit like what Microsoft has done with Windows Phone, which has the people hub. Yet Windows Phone hasn't been able really to get any traction in the market. Even though people might say it looks nice, they don't seem to be buying it.
Yeah. So the essence of BlackBerry 10 is all based on QNX. And QNX is an operating system and a company, actually, that we acquired several years ago now. And it's a very robust microkernel processing technology that essentially runs BlackBerry 10. And that enables us to do a lot of very clever things in very, very clever ways. So You know, these functionalities that we're delivering through BlackBerry 10 really use this, use the expertise of this technology to deliver that great experience to users. So people do stay, hyper connected and are able to flow through the natural progression of communicating and sharing pictures, sharing videos with their friends, family, and contacts.
So has this? I mean, you're saying flow a lot. Is the design of the way that the phone works, the sort of interface, is that all from lots of user testing saying, oh well, people keep stopping and they're jumping between apps? Is that something that's come out, or is it because Qnix sort of is a bit like that anyway, that you're sort of using gestures and so on?
Yeah, so it's a great question. Like, multitasking is something that we recognise that our kind of our target audience are doing all the time, whether it's on and off their phone. And you know, many people have talked in the smartphone game about multitasking, but very few, or we don't believe anybody has delivered multitasking in the way that we're able to. So there's a feature that you can use by making a very simple gesture up from the bottom of the phone to the left, which takes you back to your hub. And so whenever you're in an application and you realize you have a notification, whether it's an email, a Facebook update or a tweet to you, you're able just to peek into your hub, see what that is. And then if you want to go and access that message or that notification, you can dive straight into it, or you can just render back into whatever you were doing, whether it be browsing or using an application or what have you.
Sounds very similar to what you get on Apple's Notification Center or the Android Notification Center, surely.
With the gesture, we've really focused on the experience and the gesture that you would actually go and access all of this information. So, yeah, you'd probably have to try it yourself, Charles, to really understand how it works. So,
I have tried it a bit, as we said.
So that we see as a differentiator for us.
Now, I mean, we can talk about user interfaces, but of course, user interfaces aren't necessarily what sell phones. As we know, the thing that really decides whether a phone can succeed is whether the carriers get behind it, and to some extent, whether the phone company can get behind it by offering sort of encouragements, let's say, to the carriers. So, one reason why Samsung is so colossal is because it's got a tremendously large marketing budget. Is RIM going to be able to persuade the carriers to offer it at attractive prices? Do you have the marketing push going on behind this?
Well, it's a very good question, and our partners are very important to us. So we've put a lot of investment into the past few months into ensuring that our partners, both on the carrier and also the distribution and retail side, are all prepped and engaged, and the feedback that we've been getting from them, anecdotal and otherwise, has been absolutely amazing. So what you're going to see over the next few weeks is a full rollout of BlackBerry 10 Z10 devices available from all of the major carriers in the UK, plus the major retailers where you'd want to go and buy a smartphone. We'll all be stocking the Z10, so we highly recommend that you come to our website and you can find out more information at www.blackberry.co.uk to find out where your nearest retailer is.
And RIM, for example, is a big sponsor of lots of TV programs. Often, see the BlackBerry on the head of sort of various things. Is that going to continue? Is that a good use of your money?
Well, we're making the right investments, we believe, for BlackBerry 10, and ensuring people understand what the features are and the benefits of using it. So I think you'll continue to see us working again with our partners on various different marketing initiatives. And we've got a number of things up our sleeve that we're going to be executing on over the next few weeks and months. So stay tuned on that one, Charles.
Now, you've had a pretty tough year. About a year ago or so, Mike Lazaridis and Jim Balsillie left as the co-chairman and co-chief executive. Torsten Hines took over. You've had four quarters of losses. Where do you think you're going to be in a year from now?
That's a great question. And, I think if reflecting on the past year and all the changes that Torsten Hines, our current CEO and president, have made, it's a real turn in a new chapter for BlackBerry 10. So you're going to see more investment from us in the BlackBerry 10 operating system. We've already committed to more devices coming out over the coming months, and again, we're going to be investing in all areas of our ecosystem, through from the apps partners who deliver some of the great services and content that you'll be able to get on BlackBerry 10, through to the hardware and services that you can enjoy on your devices.
Oliver Pilgestorfer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
To read more on BlackBerry's launch this week and to see Charles's video review of the BlackBerry Z10 handset, Just go to guardian.co.uk/tech. And now for the week's technology news roundup with Jason Phipps.
This is the latest from the best technology news site on the web, guardian.co.uk/technology.
We're the people with the smile on the box. We're the reinventors of normal.
This week it was announced that Amazon's shares rose to an all-time high after the leading online retailer unveiled record Christmas takings of $21 billion or 13 billion sterling. Amazon, which began trading as a bookstore and now stocks everything from cameras to nappies, increased its worldwide sales to 22% since December 2011. Its continuing grab of market share from both high street retailers and online rivals has helped swell its cash pile to an amazing $12.4 billion. Amazon's profits were boosted by a major investment in 20 new distribution centres last year, three of them in the UK, allowing the retailer to reduce transport costs. However, like other US technology companies, Amazon has put this money out of the reach of the UK tax authorities by managing its European operations from Luxembourg. China is rumoured to be considering lifting a decade-long ban on games consoles, the official China Daily newspaper reported on Monday. The news sent shares of the major hardware makers such as Sony, maker of the PlayStation, and Nintendo, maker of the Wii, surging. Game consoles such as the PlayStation, Wii, and Microsoft's Xbox are banned in China, but online gaming and playing games on mobile devices are both extremely common, which analysts say limits the potential upside for Sony and rival manufacturers. The China Daily newspaper in China quoted an unnamed source as saying, "We are reviewing the policy and have conducted some surveys and held discussions with other ministries on the possibility of opening up the game console market." But before you go out and buy some shares, it's worth noting that an official at the Ministry's Cultural Market Department in China, which is responsible for the legislation, denied the report. They said the ministry is not considering lifting the ban. Due to the generosity of Google, thousands of children in the UK are to receive free Raspberry Pi computers to encourage them to develop programming skills. The Raspberry Pi is a simple, pared-down but highly powerful programmable computer devised here in the UK and geared towards educational use worldwide. A total of 15,000 of the credit card-sized bare-bone systems will be given away in collaboration with the Raspberry Pi Foundation and Google. Speaking at Chesterton Community College in Cambridge, where a group of students received the first batch of free machines, Google Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt said he'd hoped the project would lead to more children and young people learning to write code. To motivate the young computer geeks with their new Raspberry Pis, Eric Schmidt said, "Britain's innovators and entrepreneurs have changed the world. The telephone, the television and computers were all invented here." This week, tech got the Hollywood treatment. Speaking at the Sundance Film Festival premiere of the film Jobs, the biopic of Steve Jobs, actor and Twitter king Ashton Kutcher revealed that he was admitted to hospital with pancreas problems after emulating Steve Jobs and following a strict diet of fruit, nuts and seeds. Jobs, who was often reported to be a fruitarian, died of pancreatic cancer in October last year. Kutcher said, "First of all, the fruitarian diet can lead to like severe issues," he told the USA Today, and said, "I went to the hospital like 2 days before we started shooting the movie. I was like doubled over in pain. My pancreas levels were completely out of whack. It was really terrifying." Kutcher also revealed that he spent hundreds of hours studying tapes of Jobs in an effort to accurately replicate his hunched walk and mannerisms. The actor said that he felt close to the Apple founder as they shared a fascination for tech space. He also revealed an admiration for Steve Jobs' ability to bounce back after periods of struggle. That's all for this week. For these stories and so much more, go to guardian.co.uk/technology.
Alongside the battle of the handsets in the telecommunications business, there's also an emerging tech tussle between cross-platform messaging and communications apps. Most successful in this area is the WhatsApp, but the latest app to enter this territory is Just.me. The brainchild of UK tech pioneer Keith Teer, who in the 80s was behind the UK's first internet cafe, Siberia, he then set up Europe's first ISP, EasyNet. Now resident in the US, he's widely known as the co-founder of TechCrunch. Charles met up with him to find out more.
I'm Charles Arthur, and I'm here with Keith Teer, who is a British man by extraction, but Keith, you actually live in the States now.
I do. I moved to California in 1998.
Now, those with long memories may recall that you were behind the setting up of EasyNet, which is the ISP, which was above the really very famous first internet cafe, Cyberia, C-Y-B-E-R, in London's West End.
Whitfield Street.
Indeed. And sort of in the corner where the advertising sort of world was, and of course some of the tech people were. Why did you get out of that and go to the States? What was the, you know, was it not a good enough business?
It was a combination of success and failure, actually. The era was 94 through 96. We decided to do, when I say we, David Rowe, who still runs EasyNet here, and myself, decided to do EasyNet in June 94. I still remember it very well. I had to go out and buy Unix boxes and learn how to set up an ISP, and I had about 4 weeks to do it. And we opened for business where Cyberia was in August. So that was about 6 weeks later. And the first £10 check came through the letterbox that day for EasyNet subscriptions. And it so happened our building was street-facing, and we put a cafe in there and called it Cyberia, which at that time was way more famous than EasyNet. EasyNet was quietly in the background, and Cyberia was talked about everywhere. So the success part was that EasyNet, the timing couldn't have been better. Where if at that time the internet was only accessible through Daemon, and Daemon only had a DOS, MS-DOS based internet service. You couldn't use it on Windows.
So it was the time when the internet was really exploding, and
it was about to explode. Was a good business actually. To be in. It was a great business to be in, but it hadn't yet exploded. It was just about to, and we were the first consumer Windows based internet service provider. Hence the name, EasyNet. And Microsoft embraced us for the Windows 95 launch, which we did here in Leicester Square. Mm. I remember it very well. And it just took off. It was good timing. It was luck as much as judgment. And by early 96, EasyNet did a public offering on the AIM exchange, which was the first time my bank account was in the positive ever in my life, I think, from that. It had never been in the positive up until then. Cyberia, by contrast, was incredibly successful as a PR vehicle. I mean, my wife, Jenna, and Eva Pasco, her partner, did the front page of Vogue, for example, as the two women who were revolutionizing the internet doing this cyber cafe. They were on TV all over the world. We produced Cyberia magazine, which was the Wired of its time.
I'm pretty sure that I went down there myself to report on this incredible happening in London's West End. But you eventually moved on to the States, where you set up the Real Names company.
Yeah, yes. So, you know, the experience of building EasyNet was not great. I went to the States because I felt like it was a better place to be. I'll be quite frank with you. Your listeners will be able to discern probably that I still have the inklings of a Yorkshire accent. And trying to raise money with a Yorkshire accent from British-based venture capitalist for EasyNet was not just hard, but impossible. David's from the South Coast, and he has a regional accent as well. Neither one of us went to Cambridge. And, you know, Rothschild's Ventures and 3i in those days, we didn't fit the pattern. And so we couldn't raise money, and EasyNet grew 100% from revenue and not paying bills on time, so that we could use the revenue to grow the business. We did have one benefactor later on, Keith Young, who's pretty well known here in England for Net Benefit and the House magazine, the Parliamentary magazine, became an angel investor just before we went public. And did very well as a result, but we could never raise venture capital. Keith's kind of one of us. He's from Liverpool, and he understood what we were like. So going to America was driven by the belief that our kind were not welcome here. You know, we couldn't really do business here and expect to get backing. And I spent 6 months in New York trying to merge Cyberia with Cybersmith, the Harvard Square-based cyber cafe, and got to work with the American investment bank Allen & Company, and was being flown on private jets with money managers and taken seriously, really. Now, I don't think it goes to, you know, it's a very different experience. It kind of goes to your head, but I'm fairly grounded, so it didn't. But I knew I could just be myself there, and they would assume that you're talking sense unless proven otherwise. Whereas here, the feeling was, until you prove that you're great, you know, you're nothing. And so it was an uphill battle. And I honestly don't look back. I think Silicon Valley has all of the elements needed for someone who wants to realize a vision to realize the vision, or to realize that they can't. That's also possible. I've had my failures as well. Quickly.
Right.
And, you know, just because you're the wrong person won't get in the way.
So you'd done a number of things. I mean, Real Names was a company which was part owned by Microsoft, which also did work with Google. You drove the I'm Feeling Lucky button for Google for a number of years.
We did, yeah.
That sort of fell apart because Microsoft thought that it could make more money from selling ads than from directing people to browsers. Just explain for us what Real Names did, how it worked.
Real Names recognized that people around the world have languages, whereas the URL on the internet is only Latin-based. It's A through Z, 0 through 9, and a hyphen.
Certainly at that time. It's slightly changed now
because of us, actually. We were the first people to make it possible to have non-Latin-based domain names through a partnership with VeriSign. Mm. Even non-Latin domain names still have these long strings that you can't remember. So what we did is we built a natural language keyword system that pointed to URLs. So you could type Guardian Sports Section in three words with spaces, mm-hmm. and go to a URL which is this long that you'd never be able to remember. In this day and age, you would have been able to speak it, you know, mm-hmm. Guardian Sports Section, and Siri would take you there. Right. You can't speak the URL for Guardian Sports Section.
Right.
So we built what we thought of as a natural language keyword-based system, and we used a character set on the internet called UTF-8, which means that Japanese, Korean, Chinese are all equally doable, Hebrew, Arabic, it didn't matter. So it got adopted worldwide. The Chinese government became our partner in China. They paid us $10 per year per Chinese keyword. And we had them in Japan, we had them in every country, every significant country in the world. And by 2002, we started it in 98. By 2002, we were delivering a billion customers every 90 days to a website of a customer who'd bought their keywords from us. So it was very big. And Google was one of our partners. Microsoft was too. Mm. You could type it into the Microsoft browser. You could go to Google and type it in. And if we had the exact match, Google would put it right at the top or even take you right there with I Feel Lucky.
But it closed down because Microsoft particularly thought that there was more money to be made by if you typed Guardian Sports Section into a browser, taking you to their search engine and showing you an ad.
Yeah, yes. They took a short-term business decision. In 2002, the IPO window in America was closed. So their 20% ownership of Real Names, in their mind, was illiquid at best. At worst, maybe worthless. A billion page views per quarter on their search engine was roughly worth $25 million a quarter in ad revenues. So if they switched us off and stopped it being possible to navigate directly to a website with a keyword, they would get a billion extra page views every quarter on their browser, thus an extra $25 million. Short-term thinking kicked in, and they told us they were switching us off in order to monetize the revenue from search. At that time, MSN, who is our partner at Microsoft, had a new boss, and his job was to make revenue. So it's not as if he was making an incorrect decision given his goals, but from a long-term point of view, it meant Microsoft went back into the search business head-to-head with Google, a business they were very unlikely to be able to win, and abandoned a direct navigation business that allowed the world's languages to be used as web addresses in favor of search. So in my view, they abandoned a business they could win in for one they could never win in for some short-term revenue gain.
And certainly they're still not winning. I think the Microsoft Online Services division hasn't made a profit since 2003, if I'm recalling correctly. So we fast forward to today, and you are behind a new, well, let's call it an app to begin with, because social network's not quite the right word. That's sort of a bit like a social network. It's a bit like Twitter, it's a bit like Facebook, it's a bit like Instagram, it's a bit like all sorts of things. It's called just.me, mm-hmm. and you're expecting to launch it towards the end of February. So explain for us what the thinking is and what one would do with it.
So there's two ways to think about it. One is from the point of view of a user, and the other is from the point of view of the technology industry as a whole, what does it mean? From the point of view of a user, JustMe is basically a single tool that allows you to do all the things you do today using multiple tools. So, you know, people today take pictures and share them with friends. People take videos and share them with friends. People text each other. People email each other. If you look at the iPhone, to achieve most of the things people do, there's about five or six apps. The camera app, the microphone if you're doing voice recording, there's email and text for sending, the address book for who you're going to send to, there's photo stream for where the pictures are that you took, and it's all there, but it's kind of split between all these different apps. What JustMe does is it brings all of that together into one app. You can take a picture or a video or both. You click send, you get to make a choice. Is this just for you, a memory for later? Is it something you're going to share with other people using the address book? Just tell us who and we'll send it. Or is it something you want to publish because you've just witnessed something the world should know about? And if so, do you want to add Twitter and Facebook as well? You can do that. So we integrate into a single, very simple interface things that currently take lots of different applications. And it's for the purposes of helping you capture and then choose what to do with what you've captured, whether to keep it private, to share it, or to make it public.
So the idea is, ideally, I guess, for you would be that people would basically just live in the JustMe app, that they would be sort of sending messages or recording little bits of audio or sending, in effect, texts to people, that it sort of becomes a bit like WhatsApp on steroids, I guess.
That's a good way of thinking about it. It's WhatsApp is very chat-centric. And chat is one form of human interaction. We support many other forms of human interaction, like long-form messages that you read later, or short texts that you want to read right now, or videos of something that you want to keep as a memory, a kid's birthday party maybe, or a sports event. So we start, I'm a sociologist by training, so I start with what the people want to do, and then try to build an app that makes it possible, rather than looking at the apps and trying to copy them.
What has changed for you then? What do you think has changed in the past few years that has made this possible? Because, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, the idea of an app that would store all your things that you were doing, such as photos and videos, would have been nonsensical. And also the idea that you'd be sending these all to fairly random people, perhaps, or to sort of family members in this way, without using specific custom-made apps for it, you know, the email app or by text, would have been, you know, again, would have been a non-starter. What's changed particularly now?
Two big things. The first thing is that the what's known as the cloud infrastructure has evolved to the point where it's capable of storing large amounts of video images cheaply. Without a startup like ourselves having to buy tons of computers ahead of time. Amazon's a big part of that, but there's other players as well. So that's a huge change. The second is the bandwidth between the phone and the cloud is now getting to the point where even a few minutes long video, you can reasonably expect to get from the phone to the cloud without costing a lot of money and in a reasonably short space of time, so it's available. That's fairly new. I know LTE and 4G are coming to the UK now bit by bit, and I've had that in the States for about a year, and it really makes a massive difference in that world. And then the third thing is the power of the phones themselves. This iPhone that I've got here has 64 gigs of storage. It has enough memory to do a great job with video. The video is 1080p, so it's very high quality. The images are high quality. The microphone's actually very good, and so you can record audio and very well. So if you can give the user the creativity to use the camera, the microphone, whether they still have the video camera, and the keyboard to do whatever it is they want to do, you can take that and put it from the phone to the cloud, and then you can store it there for future recall. none of those, if any one of those three things were missing, you wouldn't be able to do it. And it's only very, very recently that you're getting all three.
So are you thinking of this only as a mobile app? Will there be a sort of a desktop interpretation of it? Because, you know, although mobile is important, not everyone spends all their time on a mobile. People do sort of, you know, sit at desks and things and laptops at home.
Absolutely. It isn't mobile only, actually. The beta that we're in now, and people can sign up for that if they go to just.me, the URL, there's a place to sign up, is iPhone and web. So there is a web component to it. But it's mobile first in that we think of the phone as the publishing tool. If any of your listeners were Star Trek fans, they'll remember Captain Kirk always saying, you know, Captain's Log, Stardate, something, something, and recording the events that as they were going on. Mm. We've kind of got the device now in the hands of people that can do that. You can, if you want, remember what you did after you did it through your life. And JustMe is a tool to enable that. So, I've forgotten your question, actually. Star Trek got me off on a different tangent.
Okay, the question was the desktop implementation.
Oh, yeah. So we think of the phone as a publishing tool. It's the way you capture and publish. The desktop is a way you remember. You can look back. You can do slideshows. You can go and look at your conversations or the history of your pictures or your videos and look back. Actually, we let you comment or like other people's stuff on the web as well. The only thing you can't do is create a new message and send it. And the reason is we don't take the address book from your phone and put it in the cloud. So we don't have your people there. And that's a privacy decision. It's one of the features of a decentralized computing world is that you don't have to trust the company, in this case, just me, because it doesn't take your data. Whereas with, say, Facebook or Google, you've got to put your contacts there and manage them through there. So you have to trust them. In our case, you don't have to trust us. And if we wanted to make the web a place you could create and send messages, we'd have to take your address book and put it there. I'm not saying we'll never do that. And maybe if people want us to, we will. But our first thought was to get rid of any privacy issues by not doing that.
And you mentioned iPhone. Will there be Android versions? Will there be Windows Phone versions, BlackBerry versions?
There's definitely an Android version. It's I use it now. I've got a Galaxy Nexus phone as well as an iPhone, and I'm using the Android version. It is not quite as developed as the iPhone one, so it's going to be a little bit behind it, maybe 4 to 6 weeks behind. Worst case, probably 8, something like that. I'd like to believe it will go into beta when we release the iPhone app in the App Store, which we hope will be the end of February. But that might be tight. It might not be possible. But it's close. Windows Phone and BlackBerry are not being developed right now just because there isn't enough users yet to justify the effort. And we're a small company with a limited amount of financing, so we can't do everything.
Keith Teer, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
That's all we have for you this week on Tech Weekly.
Tech Weekly was produced by me, Jason Phipps, and the music featured in this week's edition is the work of composer Brian Roth, a.k.a. Harry Kipper. And for all you science fans out there, it features the voice of Neil deGrasse Tyson, the celebrated American astrophysicist and science communicator. To hear it in its full glory, just go to Brian's SoundCloud account. That's soundcloud.com/BRIANROUTH. Or follow the link on our blog. That's guardian.co.uk/techweekly.
We'll be back next Thursday, but from now, from me, Jemima Kish, and the tech team, it's goodbye.
Not only are we in the universe is in us. And I don't know any deeper spiritual feeling than what that brings upon me.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.